A few years before writing these words, I was working in Canary Wharf in a glass building filled with experts on numbers and systems. As part of my job, I wrote reports on companies, markets, and political conditions in distant countries. The subjects of my research were serious: million-dollar oil deals in Africa, rogue trading scandals, bribery allegations in the North American construction sector. But looking out the office windows, or walls, toward North London, I felt none of that gravity, only a dulling sense of the distance between the words I wrote and their meaning. One of London's two financial centres, Canary Wharf sits on the site of the old West India Docklands in a loop of the River Thames. Ships once crammed into its docks to offload rum, sugar and coffee from the West Indies into brick warehouses, now restaurants and apartments. The docks thrived for almost 200 years until the late 1960s, when the arrival of the container prompted the shipping industry to move farther east. In 1983, most of the land was sold to a developer. Within a few years, the dock's history was buried under layers of glass and steel, the architecture of a much more liquid capital. Anyone who has visited the Canary Wharf area in East London will know how easy it is to get lost there. To the untrained eye, the district fades into itself. The glass buildings on any two streets seem the same, but arranged in a different order. In the Library of Babel, Jorge Luis Borges imagines a vast library containing all the possible 410-page books made of 25 characters. In countless hexagonal rooms, four walls of bookshelves hold Borges's imaginary books, made up of different permutations of the same letters. Something about my routine in Canary Wharf reminded me of this short story. Each report that I wrote merged with its predecessors. The words, after all, were the same: shareholder, oil block, concession, acquisition, investigation. Only their order, their syntax, was different. During my lunch breaks, I would go running in the Isle of Dogs, thinking of the ships that once came here and the materials they brought from distant parts of the world: ivory, molasses, wool, and hides. The Docklands would have smelled different, the odour of these commodities blown by the wind from the Thames. Breathing the air, one might have gotten a sense of the world growing smaller, each object testimony to new trade links, the speed and reach of the ships of the East India Company. It must have been intoxicating to witness this influx of the exotic, but also disconcerting, as the safe, known world mingled with the unfamiliar and strange. In London, Antwerp, Venice, and other centres of international trade, thinkers tried to make sense of this new world, these smells, sights, and textures. Some wrote about these new connections, travelling to distant lands, but others found ways to represent them through objects. Collectors like Hans Sloane, John Tredescant, and Ole Wurm gathered objects from around the world and placed them in single rooms, or Wunderkammers, creating a world of wonders in one closet shut. More than eccentric collections, these rooms sought to represent the expanding limits of knowledge, to visualize the connections between things and understand networks of relationships. As historian Mark Meadow writes, "In the world of the curiosity cabinet, as in any other place or period, the strands of blood, trade, authority, and agency were all present and were all interdependent. To touch any of the strands is to set all the others in sympathetic vibration." My favourite Wunderkammer belonged to the Danish physician and classics professor Ole Wurm. In 1605, Wurm set off on a grand tour that would last 8 years, travelling to Germany, Italy, France, England, and the Low Countries. As he went, he gathered objects and met with men of learning, such as the famous collector Ferrante Imperato in Naples. These items ranged from seeds, shells, and horn to mirabilia, or marvels, including a magic egg said to have been laid by a woman in Norway. Wurm conserved these things, he wrote, with the goal of, along with a short presentation of various things' history, also being able to present my audience with the things themselves to touch with their own hands and to see with their own eyes, so that they may themselves judge how that which is said fits with the things, and can acquire a more intimate knowledge of them all. During the 16th and 17th centuries, many individuals were collecting objects from the natural world: Athanasius Kircher and Ulisse Aldrovandi, as well as Imperato. Children of the Renaissance, they looked largely to classical texts to explain the objects in their collections, tracing their appearance in works such as Pliny's Natural History or Aristotle's History of Animals. Verme was influenced by these collectors, but he was fascinated by touch, the sensual experience of interacting with objects. In his preface to the catalogue of his collection, the Musei Vermiani Historia, he wrote of the clear intention to lead toward knowledge by direct observation and away from hollow verbiage. Holding an object, passing one's finger over it, smelling it, one could perceive truth and debunk myths.